Welcome to Conversations on WDRT 91.9 FM. My name is Marcy West, and today I'm happy to welcome Doug Duren to the show to discuss sharing the land, a model for private property management. Thanks for being here, Doug.
I am so happy to be here. It seems like you and I have had plenty of conversations, but this is the first time where we've sat down and recorded. So
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, so a little backstory on that. Doug and I have known each other for a few years now. We overlap when I was on the Natural Resources Board and now in my role with the Natural Resources Foundation. We co-hosted a program in the spring of 26 for private landowners and outdoor enthusiasts. So start with the introduction. Give us a little bit of the background on you and your farm and your area.
Oh, where to begin? So I was thinking about this on the way up, how to describe where I grew up. And I grew up in Cazenovia, which is pretty much due east of here, in the eastern part of the Driftless area, really on the eastern edge. And the Cuesta, which I'm sure you know the geographic term Cuesta that I live on the smooth, or our farm is on the smooth side of the Cuesta. Cuesta is a geographic ridge that has a smooth side and a steep side. And so we're actually in the Baraboo River Valley. Things look a little bit different over there than this part of the Driftless. But, you know, just in terms of the severity of the topography. But grew up in Cazenovia, and we had a farm outside of town. It's been my family. I'm fifth generation in that area. Lovely place to grow up. And I grew up during that period of time when the small family dairy farm was still a thing. So I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And in my lifetime, I've seen the changes to the economy and to the villages and have really been influenced by all of that, influenced by my family's history there. My family, the Duren family, came from Germany in the 1850s, and they were sawyers. So they bought land, cleared trees, and turned it into farm ground, and then would sell that farm ground, except for where the mill was, and then where my family's farm was, which was a couple miles from the mill. So it's a 400-acre piece of property. We farmed 110 acres, 60 acres of pasture, and the rest of it was and still is woods. So it's a little bit different than some of the farmland, at least around by us, where it's predominantly agriculture and a little bit of woods. We have a big hardwood component to our farm.
But they probably made it work with the combination on whatever they could do, right? Like you said, first the logging and then a little bit of farming, a little bit of woods.
Yeah, it's really interesting to stand there and look at it, like the barn that was built and finished in 1917, and the wood came from the land and was taken to the mill a mile away and then brought back as boards to build the barn that's on a big stone foundation that took a couple of years to build. And yeah, you know, you think about all of those things. But yeah, they carved a dairy farm out of it. And it was sort of the quintessential dairy farm when I was growing up. You know, we had a 40 cow rolling herd. We lived in town, to be clear. We lived in town, and there was someone who lived on the farm, and they milked the cows. And except for every other weekend, they got off, so we milked cows. But we did all the field work and the fencing and all that kind of stuff. So I like to say that I grew up with a farm, not on a farm. And really what the difference was is I didn't smell like cow manure when I got on the bus in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's great. And how about your professional career? As you grew up and had to leave the farm, where'd you go off to?
You know, it's funny about that is I get these questions from, you know, from the kids. About how do I get to where you are in the conservation world or whatever. And the first question is always, where do you think I am? And the second one is, it's a long and twisted road. So I went to college 4 years, but I did it over an 8-year period of time. And I had 2 degrees, one in earth science and one in history and education. So I became a high school history teacher. But in those 8 years, I ran the farm for a couple of years because they needed somebody to do it because of just happenstance. And then there's probably folks that listen to this station who did this also. And I also went off for several months one winter and hand planted pine trees around the south and west, and, you know, sort of the hippie vagabond tree planter, reforestation, planting trees in rows. And it was a wonderful experience. And, you know, it made me think about this on the way up as I was thinking about our conversation. And it's like, I didn't know there was a word for it, you know, conservation. I just kind of grew up with it. It's like going in the woods with my dad or my grandfather and learning about trees. It wasn't a dendrology class. That's a white oak tree. And why? Well, it's because it is. So, you know, I kind of grew up with that. And I've told this story before. When I was 16 years old, the librarian at the high school handed me a Sand County Almanac, and that was a pretty important thing. So conservation was always sort of a part of my life. So finally graduated from college in the mid or the early 80s, I should say, and then moved out to New Hampshire. And out there, I got involved with, well, I was a high school teacher, but in the summers, I worked in the White Mountains on the trail crew. I worked for a landscape company and got really interested in horticulture. And I also met an old Yankee who convinced me that learning how to build stone walls would be a good thing for me to, Ooh. Yeah, sort of the Robert Frost mend your fences walls.
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, so these things are all kind of happening and building that conservation experience. And then in the early 90s, 91, moved to Door County, moved back to Wisconsin, and moved to Door County. And just through a matter of opportunity, I ended up starting a landscape business in Bailey's Harbor, where we specialized in naturalization and restoration, which meant a lot of rock, but also like restoring sand dunes and planting, sure, you know, yep, native species and that sort of thing. And through that, I began to work with the County Land Conservation Department, the Department of Natural Resources, the Corps of Engineers, and all those folks. And I kind of got dialed into NRCS and got dialed into those opportunities and those programs and that kind of conservation part of it. So through that process, I ended up you know, taking classes in native species and, you know, and just learning a lot of them also. Eventually, my youngest brother died in a car accident, tragically, in 1995. And life changes as a result, and ended up moving to Madison. And so I was just thinking about that on the way up. 30 years ago, I moved to Madison, and that's when I really started to become more active in the management of our family property. My brother and my dad, my older brother and my dad, quit dairy farming in 1988. And at that point, our farm went into like the conservation programs that we all know now, like the Conservation Reserve Program, which is, you know, up for renewal right now in the Farm Bill. And so parts of our farm have been in CRP for, well, since 1988. And that's sort of how the farm became more of a conservation property than an active, sure, yeah, you know, dairy farm.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is a timing where the transition, just a little bit behind you, but coming out of college in 88, that was a time when there were a lot of changes going on in those programs. People were looking at things differently, and of course, a bit of a recession and things that were impacting how things got done as well. So that's really interesting overlap on how those kind of changes can bring you to where you are now, right? And when you tell kids that ask you how you got there, some things were in your control and,
well,
some were,
yeah,
not.
Yeah, and I don't know. opportunity, what do they say, necessity is the mother of invention? Well, I think opportunity is too. You know, you combine those two things and interests and all of that. And I think part of it, for me at least, is never having had something like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Just never been, I've never had that particular focus. But then when I think back to the librarian handing me a Sand Colony Almanac when I was 16 years old, guess what? This is something, conservation is something I've been doing for the rest of my life. It's just been in various iterations.
Right. And some of it you get paid for and some of it you don't.
That's
in
true.
In my experience.
Yes.
In my experience. But so right now you are representing a new model, not new necessarily, but we're introducing a model of sharing the land. So how, you know, one of the things about you that people should know is you're a very good hunter, and I don't know about your fishing skills, but you've been watching your social media, you get out and go hunting a bit. So I assume that was a influence as well as you were when you were growing up. And
yeah, you know, that's things that change and again, opportunity that we have. I grew up hunting and fishing around Cazenovia, and there's a lake there, and the trout streams around, and we did a lot of small game hunting and deer hunting and that sort of stuff. And it was just what we did. We were farm kids, right? But it was never like this hyper. That's not why you owned property. It was kind of a it was just something we got to do. I say this all the time, that I was never a bow hunter because I was a farm kid, and bow hunting was for people who didn't have enough to do. You know, that I had to slip that in there for Lindsay.
Yeah.
It really, you know, it wasn't recreational hunting. It was. Or fishing. I mean, we didn't go out to, oh, we're going to let this fish go. I mean, you caught a trout, you hit it in the head and took it home and ate it, you know?
Yep.
And same way with fishing in the lake in Cazenovia, bass, bluegills, crappies, that kind of stuff. The hunting was intentional, small game hunting. And I mean, even shooting pigeons out of barns, we didn't eat a lot of them. We ate some of them. And then there were people who were like, oh no, I want to take those home because grandma wants them or grandpa wants them. But we'd shoot pigeons out of barn Saturday mornings to, I don't know. I guess that was the closest thing to recreational hunting that we did. It was just a part of having a property. And in those days, you know, I mean, I started hunting when I was 12 years old, so deer hunting, I should say. And so that was 1971. And in those days in this area, deer were, I wouldn't say they were rare, but it was they were unusual enough that when you saw one, you would tell someone about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
yeah.
Hey, I saw some deer today. And now we have, you know, a very, very different situation. The other thing that was different in those days, I'm sure around here and certainly by us, is that we didn't have absentee owners. I remember, again, about 12 years old when the first person from away, as we like to call them, came and bought a piece of property in our area. And that family still owns that property. And it's actually a great example of good conservation work and all of that. But the first thing that they did was put up no trespassing signs, and we had never seen one before.
Wow.
And you know, it's like, what do you mean? And he's this old German guy, and it's verboten. You know, he'd tell us we couldn't go in there. But we've always hunted in here, and you know, you can't now. Okay, well, there's a lot of funny stories about that guy, but I won't get into too many of those. But it was a big change, you know, to be thinking about it in those terms. And now in Richland County, the last number that I heard is that 65% of the land is owned by people who don't live there. And a lot of it, that ownership is intentional ownership for recreation, weekends, and conservation. Mm-hmm. And to me, those are all kind of positive things. And it's been the change in this economy in our area from Cazenovia, which was a vibrant little town when I was a kid. You know, there were a couple of grocery stores, there was a hardware store, there were three gas stations, there was a feed mill, there were all these things, a butcher shop, all that, and now there's kind of a grocery store and one gas station, and still two bars, but very different, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and you see that with a lot of these small communities around. So those were the changes that were happening, and in that, hunting changed also.
Yeah. Yeah, and with those no trespassing signs and people not being present full time, you definitely see changes in the vegetation as well, obviously, with, you know, if they're not leasing their land for farming or whatever is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of those changes, and I'm not here to say that the change in that kind of ownership was bad.
Right, right.
I mean, at all. I mean, real a lot of real positive things. I mean, it's just change and opportunity, right? But one of the things that we see is, you know, the deer population has increased real dramatically, and hunting became more of a recreation rather than just something you did the add-on to farming, right? That's, mm-hmm. you know, we deer hunting was something we did the third week in November because the crops were in and we're ready for the winter, and now you get to go out and go hunting. And a lot of folks will bemoan that one of the problems is that we access has become a problem for hunters. And combined with that is land changes have happened, some good, some bad. You know, I remember when I was a kid, we used to go out, and if we didn't have anything else to do, Dad would say, you can go out and cut prickly ash, you know, which of course is a native, and we always found something else to do, of course, but...
Nobody wants to cut prickly ash.
Exactly. But all the invasive species started, all that kind of stuff happened, and, you know, and conservation management or land management becomes more necessary. So land ownership was changing, land management was changing, what was happening on the landscape was changing. As you said, maybe not as much pasturing, maybe not as much hard farming was going on, and then just people's attitudes about it. So as we have moved forward, I got involved with, you know, outdoor recreation and hunting and just spending time on private land. And one of the things that we've realized is that access to private land for the purposes of hunting, fishing, foraging, just taking a hike, bird watching, any of that kind of stuff, is become more difficult. And that the land needs us. And so following in the footsteps of Elder Leopold and his Riley Game Cooperative, about a decade ago, I started toying with this idea of establishing some kind of program that would help people gain access to private land in exchange for helping with conservation or making a contribution to conservation either on that land or somewhere else. And out of that came Sharing the Land.
Sharing the Land. Okay, so Sharing the Land is a nonprofit LLC. You are the originator. You are the chief.
Co-founder. I'm the
CEO.
It's come out of my mind. Big borrow, leaning heavily on Elder Leopold and the Riley Game Cooperative. Leopold started the Riley Game Cooperative out of opportunity that he ran into meeting a farmer down by Verona and Riley. And he was looking for a place to hunt, and he stopped and talked to this guy, and Reuben Paulson, and Reuben said, well, yeah, you can go ahead and hunt, but I'll tell you, we don't have many birds. He was looking for to hunt quail and pheasant, and Leopold, who was Elder Leopold, but he wasn't Elder Leopold.
Famous yet.
Said to this farmer, well, the reason you don't have a lot of game birds around here is you don't have very good habitat. Well, it really endeared him to the farmer, right?
Yeah.
But he said, how about some friends? Eventually what happened is that the Riley Game Cooperative happened, and as a result, they worked on the conservation of that property to improve it along the non-farm areas, the streams and the bottoms and that sort of thing. And what a great idea that, oh, these people from town were going to come out and help this farmer and work on this property to improve it, and in exchange for that, they got the opportunity to hunt it.
Yep.
That's the basic premise.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you know, you do wonder what that first introduction was like, because Leopold must have been a professor at that point.
Yes, he was. Yeah. And actually, Janet Silbernagel, who you may know, she was a professor emeritus at the university who grew up on a piece of property that was a part of the Riley Game Cooperative, she writes the story very well, as does Stan Temple. And we've talked to both of them. There's actually on the Sharing the Land YouTube page and also on the Savage Arms page, there's a really nice video about Riley and the Elder Leopold and that we recorded with those folks telling the story.
Yeah, that's awesome. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, broadcasting from Viroqua, Wisconsin. My name is Marcy West, and this episode of Conversations features Doug Duren, currently of Spring Green, at heart, a farm boy from Casanova. So we'll take a deeper dive into sharing the land. Okay, so we'll get into the details and sharing the land from a landowner's perspective. What is sharing the land?
Sharing the land is a conservation cooperators network where we pair landowners and access seekers. And what the landowner gets out of it is an opportunity to allow access to their property for whatever they decide in exchange for help with conservation projects on that property, or if they're, you know, wider minded than that, it gives them the opportunity to share their land with people who are contributing to conservation, you know, somewhere. My first cooperator, and who's still part of it, Brock Rosenkranz, I met him at a Conservation Congress meeting, and here's this 22-year-old kid who had gotten elected to the County Conservation Congress. And I don't know if you've ever been to any of those meetings.
I sure
know
have.
You have. And it's generally, you know, a lot of old, grumpy old guys. Okay, old guys.
They're not all grumpy.
And so it was unusual to walk into this meeting to just participate as a citizen, and here's this kid, you know. And I talked to him, and we had a nice conversation. The meeting goes on. I go home. The next year I come back, and there he is again. And he's a member of the Conservation Congress. So we have the same kind of conversation. Hey, how you doing? What's going on with you? And I said, how's your turkey season shaping up? And he goes, oh, pretty good. I said, well, where do you hunt? He goes, well, I hunt on this private land, but it was just sold. And the new owner is a hunter, and he's not going to allow access to me there now. So I'm going to have to figure something else out. But I'll do okay. And so here's this kid who's volunteering his time to be on the Conservation Congress. In my mind, I was like, that's the kind of guy I want on my property.
Yeah.
And I said, well, if you find that you're not finding another piece of property to hunt, you come and hunt on my place. And, you know, Brock has told me this. He goes, at that very moment, I quit looking for another place to hunt.
Richland County has a reputation for turkey hunting.
Yeah. And so, and he's still a part of it. And actually really proud of Brock. He had a degree in construction and was had a little construction company. And through the Conservation Congress, he got involved with the R3 or Learn to Hunt program. Eventually got hired by the National Deer Association to be their field-to-fork coordinator, full-time job. And then last year, he transitioned from NDA to working with the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association.
NDA is National Deer Association.
National Deer Association.
Sorry, there's a world of acronyms in conservation.
Yes, there are. And I'm usually pretty good about actually saying them. But and so here, you know, talk about a kid who's like, tell me about, could you explain to me how I can get to where you got in conservation? And he never really said that to me so much as we just had a conversation about it. And his dad, Bob Rosenkranz, was a biology teacher and environmental ed teacher at Richland Center High School. Just a tremendous guy. And I mean, he had taken Brock to, they worked at the Leopold Foundation peeling logs when they were building the buildings and that kind of stuff.
Nice.
So, I mean, here's a kid who is really, you know, that kind of thing. So that, to me, that really spoke to me. But when I was first trying to decide about sharing the land and whether it was going to work or not, one of the things that I did was put a post up on my Instagram page that said, I'm interested in having four groups of two people come to the farm and turkey hunt. These are the times that I have available. All I ask for is that we would spend a few hours together working on a project at the farm, and then I'll take you out turkey hunting one day, and then you can hunt for the next couple of days. And folks who were coming from a distance, I said, we have a place for you to stay in the farmhouse there. And I thought, you know, I'll get 15 or 20 applicants. This will be good. Woke up the next morning and there were like 88 messages. Yeah. So I had a lot to sort through. But I did that and I had a really good experience with it as a landowner. So I invited these people. We did this. They did that. They did a little bit of work. It wasn't a lot, but it was time that we got to spend together doing something together and talking. And you know, kind of get a cut of their jib, as it were. And so one of those, or a couple of those people are still involved with my cooperative again, 10 years later. You know, the rest of them was kind of just a one opportunity. So the landowner is really working with people who are willing to come in and contribute to their property or contribute to conservation. And between them, they develop a relationship. Ultimately, we'd like to think that a community will develop from that. But it's sort of the age-old thing. You do something for me, I'll do something for you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a basic barter system. Lindsay, the co-founder, likes to say that it's a conservation, it's like conservation dating, the way we've set it up on the website.
Yeah,
now.
Matchmaking.
Yeah, so, and that's really what it is. That's a better way of saying it. We'll call it conservation matchmaking now. And so what we did was, over time, developed a website. We have some sponsors that, you know, helped us on the financial end of it. And what we really have is that the access seeker builds a conservation resume, which is what it sounds like. It's a resume that's built on what their conservation interests are, what they know, what they'd like to know, what their attitudes are, that sort of thing. And the landowner fills out a similar profile. It's called a cooperating land profile. And on there, they describe their property, they describe themselves, they describe what they're interested in, what kind of access that they have available, what kind of projects they need help with. And through the magic of the computers and all of that, we on the back end, we actually have the program, the way it sets up is Lindsay presses a button when we get a new landowner, and it'll, based on the criteria that both have filled out, it'll actually rank, give us a list of possible matches, and then rank them based on those, all of that criteria. Then we send that to the landowner, we send those to the landowner, and the landowner decides if any of those people are someone that they're interested in talking with. So it's very much like applying for a position, right? It's very mm-hmm. much like applying for a job. And they reach out to them, and we have on the web, on the sharingland.com website, we have when a landowner signs up, we send them a bunch of information and frequently asked questions and a kind of a guideline for here's how to proceed. And to proceed small, to be very clear about things, we have we deal with things like insurance, liability. There's an agreement, and then we really do talk about expectations.
Sure,
it's really important to have like realistic expectations, and on both sides.
I was going to say the landowner has to have expectations as far as what the skill level is of the person.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. We have like 57 landowners now in 15 states, and we have thousands of conservation resumes. I mean, I'm sure you're not shocked to find out that the supply is not as much as the demand.
Sure.
And so we're working on that. But it's really interesting because the landowners are, everyone's different. We have one landowner in Richland County, John Clear, who you may or may not know, but John has been involved with conservation for years. He's on the Conservation Congress. He was a biology teacher. I mean, he's the kind of guy who would pick up a roadkill deer along the way, take it to biology class, and they would dissect it and then butcher it and that kind of thing. Very involved with learn to hunts and conservation issues. And he wasn't, when he signed up, he said, well, you know, I hope it's okay, but I'd rather have people who don't have a lot of knowledge. I'd rather have like family and, or younger people, people that, you know, I'd like to help them learn about this. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, I just had a meeting with one of who's going to become a new cooperator on our place yesterday. I was looking for some pretty serious skills. I need pesticide application. I really need a burn boss. And I have a couple of people who are pretty experienced with burn. I got my guy.
Oh, great.
We had a great time yesterday, like talking about the farm and, you know, kind of working through all those sort of things. So each landowner can have different ideas, different expectations. But we also encourage them to be realistic that, mm-hmm. I mean, really, don't expect someone to run a chainsaw who doesn't have like chainsaw safety classes.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, all of those kinds of things are really important.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, here's a great example of a project we did on our place. I'm in the CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program.
Okay.
Right?
So is that federal or state?
That is federal. It's administered through NRCS.
Natural Resource Conservation Service. Got it.
What used to be the Soil Conservation Service is now a Natural Resource Conservation Service. And it's a program where folks like our farm that have done a lot of program work get the opportunity to apply for additional, a little more specialty opportunities. So we applied to put in pollinator habitats and to do some limbing and thinning in a pine plantation that we had. So, and there's money, and there's a payment involved. And they don't really care how you get that done. They care that it gets done. It's a contract. So I actually had my a group of my cooperators come out and help with the limbing of the pine trees. Now, it would have been easier had we done it with chainsaws and that kind of stuff, but there were six or eight of us. And so we walked through with handsaws and loppers, and the whole time we're talking. Mm-hmm. And talking about why we're doing this, what's the point of this. They're thinking about what's the point of it from a conservation standpoint, but how the wildlife are going to benefit from it. We're stacking the brush up in piles for bunny huts and that sort of thing. And then at the end of it, I called the NRCS office, and they send the person out to certify it. And it was, I mean, it's not a get rich quick scheme or anything, yeah. But there was a payment involved. So indirectly, those folks helped me get the project done that I got a cost share payment for.
Nice. Yeah. And from the landowner's perspective, let's jump into some of those frequently asked questions, because like you said, the idea of having a stranger out on my land with a chainsaw makes me a little nervous. So what is the liability? That's usually the first question that I've heard is, what's my liability as a landowner?
Exactly. Well, the way I often start that response is, do you have people coming to your property now? And the response is, well, sure. I said, well, what's your liability with them? And every landowner goes, mm-hmm. Doesn't say a word. It's like they hadn't considered it before, right? So if you have someone coming and working on your property, you probably have liability insurance on your property, some sort of comprehensive, you should have if you don't, an umbrella policy. But if in the state of Wisconsin, we have all states have this, but Wisconsin has a sort of a unique one, and that is a recreational access law. And so you can allow, if you're allowing people to come onto your property for the purpose of recreating, you can take up to $2,000 in per person in payment or services or work and still be covered under this recreational access law, which means you're not, that they're assuming a certain liability by doing that kind of stuff. Well, again, let's step back to, you're not going to have somebody running a chainsaw who's never run a chainsaw before, right? The other part of it is, like on our farm, I have three kinds of liability. One is an umbrella policy for liability. Another is specific to allowing access. We lease our farm, a little secret of the Durin farm, is that I lease the farm for bow hunting to a group of four people every fall. And again, because I'm not a bow hunter, because that's for people who don't have enough to do.
Boy, my husband's going to not like that comment.
Oh, I didn't know your husband was a bow hunter.
Bow hunters appreciate the woods in a different way than...
Yeah, well, they have time, apparently, but...
we're not going to settle this.
No, it's just been something. I have great admiration for bow hunters, yep, because they should have at least a skill set that's different than somebody who's going to go out and sit on a stump opening morning with a rifle. Yep. They have to read the woods a little different. They have to be more patient. They should be practicing with that bow a lot if they're going to go out with it, with a long bow anyway, as opposed to a crossbow. So I have insurance that covers anything that they do that's related to their hunting. Mm-hmm. We have a lease agreement in place that looks a lot like a sharing the land agreement. Just the exchange is different, right?
Sure.
And that any of that work that they do, like if they're limbing trees or doing whatever kind of work to get ready for hunting, is covered by that as well. The agreement that we have that was insisted on by the insurance company also has a hold harmless agreement, part of it, or hold harmless clause. Then also there's a couple of different insurance companies out there. One that we work with is the American Hunting Lease Association, and they consider what we're doing with sharing the land to be like a hunting lease. So sure, if people are coming and doing work on a property that's related to their hunting or their recreation opportunities,
access.
Yeah, their access, that then that's covered as well. So the way you mitigate liability is, one, knowing the people, having those conversations with them. I mean, nothing's airtight, right? But having those conversations with them, getting to know them, having an agreement, a signed agreement. And if people don't want to sign an agreement, then probably not, you know, I mean, mm-hmm, might concern you a little bit. Making sure that they're qualified to be able to do the things that they say. And on their resume, we have levels of, because there are levels of chainsaw safety classes, there are levels of pesticide applications, there are levels of being a burn boss and all of those sort of things. So if you're looking for those skills, you're looking for someone who has those, mm-hmm, things. So you know you're getting someone who's qualified to do that work. So that, you know, that's a part of it too. So they haven't even gotten to the point where they've become a cooperator until you've kind of gone through that resume and say, this is the kind of person that I'm looking for.
You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. My name is Marcy West. Thank you for tuning in to Conversations. My guest today is Doug Durin, and we are talking about a wide variety of issues facing rural property owners. Okay, thanks, Doug, and we'll get into this from the access seeker's perspective now. Sharing the land, share means that you have a landowner, you've matched them with somebody that wants access. It started as hunting access, but it's definitely evolved from there. Give some other examples of who wants access to private land.
That's really interesting, because it has evolved, and you know, if you're thinking about these things, you're leaving your opportunities open. Who else? Bird watchers, people who want to camp, who can't necessarily, or who are interested in sort of a different experience that way. Foragers has been a huge thing. And quite honestly, as a landowner, I've had a couple of different foragers on my property, and I've learned a lot from them.
Sure.
I mean, we all know morels, right, and ramps, but suddenly, you know, I'm peeling the fruit off of prickly ash and turning it into peppercorns and stuff like that. But and all of the other mushrooms that, you know, that are out there, and different things that you can forage for. One of my cooperators started as a person who's just looking for a place to walk his dog, who needed big area for him to be able to run his dog, because his dog is
active.
Very energetic. And I was like, yeah, man, I got a spot for that. And he's helped me with some pretty small projects, but he's also, we started out small with something like that, and now he's a part of our deer hunting group as well.
Mm-hmm.
As a landowner, one of the other things that I've had people, you know, deer hunting is such a big thing, and people wanted deer hunting. And, you know, as you and I've talked about a lot, I'm pretty involved with deer management. And during the antlerless seasons, people who had applied, I'm like, yeah, you can come out and antlerless hunt. And because if they're interested in harvesting a deer for, you know, strictly for meat, the antlerless hunt's a great time for doing that. And I set that up pretty safely, have them sit in particular places. And they're like, yeah, but what am I going to do in exchange? And I was like, well, this is about making a contribution to conservation. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to harvest an antlerless deer. That's a contribution to conservation. You're going to get it tested for chronic wasting disease so that I know and you know. And that's a contribution to conservation in my mind. And you're going to take good care of that deer and, you know, consume it if you choose to, if it's positive, or consume it if you find out that it's not positive. I don't really make a lot of judgments anymore about people who are
But you're just informed.
Yeah.
The CW test.
Yeah, and it's informing me as a landowner. And that's a contribution to conservation as far as I'm concerned. Almost every one of those people who've done that, though, have said, but what can I do to help you on the farm? What else can you do? Access seekers don't have to have chainsaw certification. They don't have to, you know, depending on what the landowner wants. I've had folks who have just come and helped me with, like, cleaning up the barn. I have a guy who came and replaced, when he's a carpenter, he replaced a couple of windows in the old house. Justin, the guy I was talking about with the dog, he came and helped me with the CWD program. I have a dumpster program and the kiosk, and he helps out with that. And that's not manned space flight. You know, you take the bag and you put it in the truck and take it and get it, you know, that kind of thing. And so when landowners start to think about it, there are so many opportunities on your property of stuff that needs to be done, you know, that isn't, it's necessary, but it's not necessarily high skilled. You'd be LOPR certified, I think is what you said during the break. But it's important. It's just stuff that needs to be done. I've had people, you know, picking up, walking the ditches at the farm and picking up, you know, trash that people throw out and stuff like that.
Yeah. So another concern might be, oh, I don't want people coming and going on my land all the time. Is there a notification process every time, or do you schedule your work days?
That's a great question, and that's exactly that you're hitting it right on the head. This is a relationship that develops. It's not like a lease. Like if someone leases a property year round, they pretty much have unfettered access to it. We encourage, and I expect that anybody who's a part of my cooperative, we set up times when they're going to come and work, and we coordinate the hunting and that sort of thing as well. It's not really that time consuming. In fact, I've gone so far as to put one of my cooperators, Brock again, in charge of scheduling some of the hunting stuff because he's usually there.
Right.
So one of the things that we do is that we give the landowner an Onyx, which is a mapping software subscription. We encourage the access seekers to get them, and usually we can get one of those for them too, at least to get them started with it. And it's pretty easy to communicate back and forth with the mapping software. And then, you know, we're all carrying these phones around in our pockets that text message, and we have text groups. So our expectation is that it's very clear between the landowner and the access seeker of when they're going to be there, what's going to happen, and then when they're not going to be there. No one comes to my property, even Justin, when he comes and walks his dog. or runs his dog, will send me a message and say, hey, is it okay if I go out today?
Yeah.
And my answer has never been no. I may have said, oh, we did some spraying in this part of the property. You might not want to go there, you know, or something like that. But he also kind of knows, well, it's, you know, deer season. I guess we're not doing it then. So those expectations and that communication is really important.
Yep. And again, you can check that, right? You learn that through the relationship, through the matchmaking and the communication. It from the start, it just made so much sense to me because, as I said before, with Natural Resources Board is how I think we first met on the chronic wasting disease issue. Richland County is kind of a hotbed for CWD.
Yeah, it really is. Last year in the county, 40% of the deer that were tested positive. I'm on the County Deer Advisory Council, which, to be perfectly honest with you, I think some of the biggest issues with natural resource management, particularly deer, is that the inmates are kind of running the asylum, you know, that deer hunters have an outsized influence on, or the deer hunting community has an outsized influence on what happens with that resource management. You know, the North American model of wildlife conservation says that management should be science-based. Well, when we were doing science-based management here in Wisconsin, a small segment of 5% of the population, which makes up the hunting communities, 5% of the overall population of the state, and then a segment of that, so what, a couple of percent of the people in the state had an outsized influence on the Natural Resources Board, but also with the legislature and the governor. And suddenly we weren't managing based on the science and the advice of the best advice that we had from our managers, and now it was based on the whims of folks that, you know, were in it for the, you know, the what I like to call the whitetail industrial complex, that they that all is forsaken except for the whitetail deer, and they're just one segment of the program. So, man, I could talk about chronic wasting disease for days.
Well, I just think it goes back to what we as landowners can do. So there does seem to be an incredible influence. I agree. The legislature took some things away from the Natural Resources Board and the Department of Natural Resources. So those management decisions aren't made as much. But in an example like sharing the landowner can have some influence over that. And even back to the Leopold example, I mean, Leopold was all about managing the whole system.
Right.
And so it's like when the deer herd got out of whack, whether it be chronic wasting disease or blue tongue or the amount of browse that forests and our native community of plants is getting hit with, you know, why would the non-hunter care, but a landowner should care?
Well,
wait, I've got Doug Dern speechless. I want that recorded.
Tongue-tied, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. When the thing that comes to mind is in the 40s, how Leopold was vilified for his deer management proposals for northern Wisconsin, where the deer were over-browsing and destroying the habitat up there. The same things happen in southwest Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in real time in my lifetime. Why don't we have as many native understory plants like the viburnums and serviceberries? And well, it's because that's what the deer browse on. They don't browse on multiflora rose and autumn olive and honeysuckle and all of that.
Oh, so, how I wish they did.
yeah. But where the native species are browsed way back by the deer, the invasive species take advantage of the opportunity. Not to mention, if you're in the business of trying to regenerate oak like I am, you have real concerns about that. So part of our motivation has been to require even though we don't have Earn-A-Buck anymore in the state, we're still killing 3 to 5 does or antlerless deer for every antlered buck that we shoot. And I just, those are my expectations of my access seekers and anybody who hunts my property, my brother, my nephews, my cousins, my friends who, you know, been invited who aren't necessarily a part of the cooperative. Those are the expectations. And that's helping me as a landowner meet my management goal on the hunting side of it. And then the access seekers who are helping with the work are also helping me meet my management goals as a landowner.
Yep. Yep. Good example. Yeah. And we do have this kind of terrible storm going on where the number of hunters is going down. So you've also hosted mentor hunts and trying to get the younger folks involved in hunting and folks who want to have a protein source come off the land. And so I think that, you know, that combination, we're trying. Is the point, right?
Oh, right. And I think that when you and I first started talking, that was really what it was about. It's there's times, in fact, talking with you, there were times when it's like, oh, I feel so much better after we would have our conversations. Because it's just like, well, first of all, there was somebody on the Natural Resources Board who cared about this kind of stuff. But then also, anytime I speak with someone who's like-minded about those sort of things, it sort of, it, you know, props you up, because sometimes you feel like you're out there on an island. The hunting community, I don't know what it is about white-tailed deer that people are...
Tradition.
Yeah, but I mean, some of it's just their concern. Well, but when I was a kid, you shot a buck with one antler on it, you were excited about it, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's become, if it's not 150 inches, it doesn't even turn 150 inches of antlers, for those of you who aren't a deer hunter, that it doesn't even turn people's heads. And at least some segment of it. And one of the things that's been really fun about sharing the land and also me kind of changing my mind about that kind of stuff, I abandoned the whole idea of buck management, you know, big giant buck management, about a decade ago. And let's just have fun hunting.
Yeah.
And be and think about all the different things that we're doing, because I didn't want people hunting on my property going, well, I don't know if that deer is big, that buck is big enough or whatever. So getting away from that was one of the most freeing things ever. It was just like, we're just there deer hunting. Having learned to hunt, bringing in younger people, adult onset hunters are also another one that is one of my favorite groups of people, because they are usually there specifically for the reason that you said. They want to have the opportunity to harvest a deer, learn how to butcher it, take care of it themselves. This wasn't a tradition for them. This was a sort of a more honest acquisition of protein.
Right.
I love having those kind of groups around. And our sponsors, like Vortex Optics and Onyx Maps and Can-Am and Savage Guns and all of those folks are, that's the thing they want to encourage. There's some, you know, reasons for them to do it, but that's the kind of stuff that they're really supportive of.
Mm-hmm. And it is, it, you know, we didn't mention it, but they can see it on your website, that Sharing the Land is a nationwide organization,
yeah.
Multiple states, and with sponsors as a nonprofit. But again, I think the point for our community and especially the Driftless area, where we have so many issues kind of going on at the same time in terms of conservation, this is really about landowners having influence, and there are a number of organizations that we've mentioned that can help.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
And so the information's out there if you're a private landowner or if you're an access seeker.
Yeah, and if you go on to the Sharing the Land website, we will help connect you with those things if you have issue with that. Like, and even on my DougDuran.com landscape, because website, DougDuran.com website. I have a section there about land management, another section about CWD, and you go on there and it's sort of, here are all these people who are there to help you.
Yeah.
The NRCS, the County Land Conservation Department, DNR Forestry, all of these, you know, opportunities, the Extension Office, all of those folks who are there to help you as a landowner. Think about, gee, I bought this land, or I'm involved with this land, how can I do the best I can for it?
Yeah.
And, so then you're not spending a bunch of time like in your own head trying to figure it out. people are willing to help you. You still get to make the landowner still deciding on their goals and objectives and the work that they want to do, and how they want to enjoy that property. But part of our goal with all of that is to help folks understand that you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, that there is this opportunity. And the other thing I like them to understand that is my conservation mantra, and that is, it's not ours, it's just our turn. And I mean, that's the way I feel about our property. It's been in my family for so long. It was an easy thing to get to in my mind, and it's just the Leopoldian land ethic came out of the mouth of a farm boy from Casanova.
Yeah, there you go. And that is one of the things that we've heard over and over again is folks who buy property and think you can sit on your deck and just watch it over the years. It's an investment, and it takes some work. It's not going to stay the same.
Yeah, it's a participation thing.
Activity.
And so there's opportunities, plenty of opportunities for getting other people involved with it.
Yeah. So as we round out here, we close up. Anything else you wanna highlight? What's coming up in your world?
I've got a whole list of things, but one of the fun things that I have coming up is an important thing is if you're in the Minneapolis area on July 9th, it's a Thursday 9th, I will be opening with my friend Augie Doherty for a benefit concert for the Sportsmen for the Boundary Waters. And that's going to be at the place called the Hook and Ladder in Minneapolis. Augie and I are going to go out and sit down and play some songs and talk, and that's going to be super fun. And the other things that are going on is,
work and...
Yeah, all kinds of things. My friend Ryan Callahan said conservation never sleeps.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Yeah, we've got a bunch of them off of this list, that's for sure. So folks can learn more at sharingtheland.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be upcoming events posted. You know, if they want to get in touch, that resume is the first thing to do.
Yep.
But it's really an open conversation. And I think one of the other things is to get involved. You mentioned the County Deer Advisory Committee, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. We have a local representative for Natural Resources Board, mm-hmm. no longer myself, mm-hmm. but... you know, there's
a suitable
just
replacement, though.
An excellent replacement. So there's all kinds of ways to get involved, and a number of organizations here in the Driftless as well. So, again, Doug, thank you so much for coming on and talking about sharing the land. It's always a pleasure to get in this think tank. And again, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to Conversations on WDRT 91.9 FM, recorded at the WDRT studio in Viroqua, Wisconsin. This is Marcy West, and I have a huge thank you to my friend Doug Duren for joining me today, and special thanks to Steve Brandel for recording and technical assistance. We all appreciate each of you who listen and support community radio. You can find recordings of this and other conversations on the WDRT Archives webpage at wdrt.org. Hope you have a great day. Thank you.